You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When it comes to Father's Day, dads want steak. And there's still time to deliver uncompromising quality and flavor with delicious gifts from America's original butcher, Omaha Steaks. Plus, get an extra $35 off with code THANKSDAD when you shop at omahasteaks.com today. Hurry, there's still time to give dad something incredible for the big day. Shop now at omahasteaks.com and get an extra $35 off with code THANKSDAD. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details.
This season of Desert Island Dishes is sponsored by Maldon Salt, the finest natural sea salt flakes handcrafted from the British coastline. They are, quite frankly, the masters of salt, putting craft, care, and passion into everything they do. You only have to read one of my recipes to know that I use Maldon Salt every single day for all of my cooking. To say I am a fan is an understatement, so to be working with them this season is a dream come true. I'm often asked about the secret to getting better at cooking, and my answer is honestly always the same. It comes down to seasoning, and not just as an afterthought. You have to season at every stage, and that's why I love Maldon Salt. It's light and delicate due to the soft and crunchy pyramid-shaped flakes, and it's just the easiest way to take simple dishes to the next level. Trust me, your cooking life will not be the same. Thank you very much to Maldon Salt. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, how are you all? It's been a little while since I did this, but it feels so nice to be back. I've missed you. And I just wanted to say quickly, thank you so much for all of the messages that you've sent me telling me that you missed the podcast or are re-listening to old episodes. It makes my day every time I hear that, and it's very nice to be missed. We have a brilliant season lined up for you with some amazing guests, which I'm really excited for you to hear. Kicking off in true style, we are starting with a real culinary icon. Claire is someone I've looked up to and admired for everything she's achieved. And I got the feeling after meeting her that she's the kind of person who would be successful in whatever she chose to do. But how lucky for the world that she chose cooking. She also just proves that you can be very successful, but also be a genuinely really nice person as well, which is equally as important, I think we can all agree. This episode felt very special because we were welcomed into her beautiful restaurant, Core by Claire Smith, which we all know is notoriously hard to get into. We recorded this in the most amazing wine cellar, so if you can hear the gentle hum of a fridge in the background, know that it was for a very good cause and that there was some very nice wine being kept nice and cool. So without further ado, here is the first episode of the new season. I do hope you enjoy. My guest today is Claire Smith. Claire is one of the world's most respected chefs, and she is the first and only British female chef to be awarded 3 Michelin stars, which she achieved for her restaurant, Core by Claire Smith in Notting Hill. Growing up on a farm in Northern Ireland, her passion for food began at a young age and even inspired some of her most famous dishes from the restaurant. By the time she was 17, she'd graduated from culinary school and moved to London to work with and learn from the world's best chefs. She went on to train in some of the most celebrated kitchens in the world, including with Alain Ducasse and Gordon Ramsay. She would go on to break new ground by becoming chef patron of 3 Michelin-starred restaurant Gordon Ramsay before going on to open her own restaurant in 2017. And it took less than 3 years for her to be awarded her own 3 Michelin stars. Claire has received numerous awards, including the title of World's Best Chef. And in 2013, Claire was awarded an MBE for services to the hospitality industry. She has been described as something of a perfectionist, with the tunnel vision focus of an elite athlete and the unstoppable stamina of a goods train while being completely unpretentious. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you.
What do you think about that quote there at the end? Do you think that sums you up in a nutshell?
No, I mean, it's quite, I don't know, I don't think I've heard that one about the train before.
I like the idea of the tunnel vision focus of an elite athlete because it makes a lot of sense. Like, to be the best at anything, it doesn't just happen. It takes dedication day to day. Do you think that's something that people underestimate about success?
Yeah, I often compare what we do to sports and athletes, and actually even probably take it maybe even further than that, where at the older I get, I actually really, really focus on my fitness and well-being. It's a huge part of continuing to be successful. I think more and more about that. To stay at an elite level, you have to almost put more into yourself to stay that fit, healthy, strong, you know, mentally focused, to have that longevity.
Yeah, that's so true. I guess because cooking is physically demanding, but like you say, all of those things are also beneficial mentally. So it's sort of a no-brainer.
I would say I've got a huge team that physically do most of the cooking, but it's really about that, sort of leading the team, staying focused. I guess creativity is a huge part of it as well, running a business on two sides of the planet.
Yeah.
And just doing lots and lots of different things. So I don't really have a routine as such. I'm all over the place doing lots of different things, traveling a lot. But you need to be on top of your game and really, really look after yourself to be able to perform at top level.
It's so true. You seem to have decided at a very young age that cooking was what you wanted to do, which we're obviously going to come on to later. But was there a plan B? Like, what do you think you would have ended up doing if you hadn't found cooking?
I loved horse riding, so I did love sports. I would have probably been a professional show jumper.
That would have been cool.
Yeah, it would have been a very, very different life choice, but I love being outdoors and I grew up with horses. I love animals. I've got a real competitive spirit as well.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Do you think that's been quite an important part of your career?
I think it definitely has been. And I guess the stamina also is a big, big part of it. I think that, you know, as a woman in, you know, often male-dominated industries, you know, kitchens filled with, you know, young men, and they're obviously quite show-offs and look at me, what I can do. And, you know, as a young woman, you think, well, I got overlooked quite a lot, but I knew I was stronger. So I knew I had the stamina to outlast. And I've always had that competitive edge to just keep going.
I love that, Claire. Okay, so you grew up on a farm in Northern Ireland and food was always part of your life, home-cooked and rustic food. But let's dive straight into the first desert island dish. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
It would be something along the lines of, I guess an Irish stew is the best way to sum it up to most people. But we would cook these sort of long overnight pots of stews and soups with lots of sort of slow cooked meat, lamb or beef, pearl barley, pulses, grains. And that would be very much something that would fill the whole house. Of a beautiful aroma as you wake up in the morning, smell it. And that was very much a style of cooking that my mum would do.
So nice. You say that you practically grew up in restaurants, hanging out at age 12 in the hotel kitchen where your mum worked. Was she a chef?
No, she worked as a waitress in front of house. And as part-time, you know, she did lots of things as well as helping with the farm. But I guess that was a connection to, you know, a part-time job for me as well at school, in my school holidays, and I just loved it. You know, I loved being part of a team as well and doing something. It was really good fun to me, and always earning pocket money, so that was great.
During the school holidays, as you say, you worked at the local restaurant, and I think it was there that there was a chef who'd worked in Michelin restaurants, and you say that's where you first learned about fine dining. How do you define fine dining?
It's an art form, I guess. I think that, you know, we have, you know, casual, typical traditional food or dishes. When you move into the world of Michelin starred, and certainly with three Michelin star food, it's really haute couture. So it's like you're creating and designing your own dishes with, I would personally cook with a real sort of French classical background, and there's that foundation of cookery, but then you kind of take it in your own direction.
Was that something when you started out? Obviously cooking is so creative, but as you're working your way up the ladder, you're kind of fulfilling someone else's vision until you get to the point that you're at. Was that kind of always what you're working towards, or did you find it still satisfying to create someone else's vision?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you must learn under the masters. It's like you're gathering skills all the way until it's like, I guess you say, learn to play an instrument, or, you know, but you're learning all those skills, the practice, the muscle memory, and building up all that knowledge of flavors, different palettes, and also experience, because we're dealing with nature every day. So you need to have that experience, and then learning under people with different styles also, but things that you would really connect with naturally. And then until I had enough information, till I grew to a stage where I was really thinking about my own dishes, thinking what I would do if I had that product. And then it was like I used to draw it, you know, and I had a notebook filled with drawings and dishes that I created in my mind, and I was waiting for the opportunity to start to put those or bring them into real life.
So are you good at drawing?
No.
I don't believe that. You can't be as creative as you are on the plate and also not be a good artist. I want to see those sketches.
No, you don't. No, I was always very creative at school. I was always good at art, and it's natural. Yeah.
Okay. You've said that, in your words, you are quite greedy. And obviously with cooking, there's this amazingly creative side of it. But do you think in your experience it is possible to become a great chef without being quite greedy?
No, I just, you have to love food. You have to love it. Like, I am really, like, honestly, really greedy. Some of my previous head chefs would say they just didn't know how I was so slim, because I would eat all the time. I love food. I love picking at things. I think it's really important to be curious. And like, when I'm saying about, like, picking up flavors, you've got, like, this memory bank that's there. It's really important to taste as many things as you can. You're building this library up in your head. And then it's like when you think about, putting two flavors together, or remembering things. So curiosity is huge, and loving food is very, very important.
In terms of the food memory, how important do you think that is to start at an early age? Or is it possible that you can learn all of those things as an adult? It's just more difficult.
I think you can learn it as an adult. I was very lucky. I didn't realize that. You know, until much later on in life, that actually I had quite a really good food upbringing. But I definitely think your palate changes. You know, we all know that as we grow up, palate changes, and you become more, say, educated in your palate. And I think it is possible to change that.
It's time to talk about the second desert island dish. What's the first dish you learned to cook?
So it would have been one of those dishes that my mum would have cooked at home, those simple Irish... it would have been champ, something to do with potatoes, with scallions, butter, salt, pepper. Very simple, but basic, delicious, wholesome food. And, you know, we had potatoes with every meal of some form.
So
normally they were boiled, but yeah, simple dishes like champ.
And how old do you think you would have been?
I was involved with cooking from a very young age. You know, we were all given chores at home, and it probably would have been about the age of 8 or 9. So we were peeling potatoes or somehow involved in cooking.
And it was at a very young age that you decided to pursue a career in food. I think I read that you finished culinary school by the age of 17 and then you moved to London. That's a huge thing to move country at such a young age. How did you find that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I actually left home when I was 16.
To go to school?
Yeah, to go to college in England.
Okay.
And I guess it was, I don't know if I think I was naive, headstrong. I had, you know, this real vision of what I wanted to do. And I was just like, yeah, that was it for me. I was gone. And I was a year ahead always at school. So I started early because my birthday's in September. So being in September, but I started school early because I was always ahead. So I was finished college already and I was still 17. And then trying to get a job in London, and I was still under the age of 18, you know, going to top-level kitchens. But I did find an amazing place to go, which was probably the best foundation I could have had at that age, which was Bibendum in South Kensington, under a chef called Simon Hopkinson. And, yeah, just amazing foundation of food and produce. I still remember the dishes. I mean, it was really, really stuck in my mind.
Did you have to do a trial to get that job?
Yes. Yeah. But they were lovely. Unlike lots of other places that I had been for trials in those days, kitchens were very different places.
Yeah.
But yeah, I loved every minute of working there.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about that because obviously we hear so much about the environment and historically it can be very macho and obviously it varies kitchen to kitchen. You don't have to tell us where, but have you had any terrible kitchen experiences?
Yeah, many. But I think it's you learn as much from the bad as you do the good.
Yeah.
And I think that the challenges of overcoming that, and it was always the challenge to overcome. We used to always overcome it quite quickly because once you prove that you were strong enough and you're good enough, everyone wanted you in the team.
Okay. Do you feel like sometimes it was a challenge, like they did it on purpose?
Definitely. You know, I think if you're going back 20 odd years ago, kitchens were very, very different. It's changed so much. And it kind of always frustrates me a little bit when people still think that hospitality is like that, because it just isn't.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, and it's very rare that you would find that kind of behaviour these days. It wouldn't be tolerated.
Yeah, that's interesting. But you were so young and you were so far away from home. I feel like that whole thing was really brave. Did it feel brave at the time?
I don't know if it was brave, stupid, naive. I look back at it, Claire, let's go with brave. Yeah, I just think, you know, now when I see young kids coming in, I think, oh, they're so young. If I see a 16-year-old, I'm like, wow. And then I really, you know, I'm like, I was 16. But I was from a small town and I just kind of knew that that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and when you're 16, it feels so grown up. Like you think you are a grown up. It's one thing to love cooking and be really passionate about food, but working in a restaurant is a very distinct way of life. I know you've said the first job you had, you absolutely loved it. Did you ever have any doubt that the restaurant environment was where you wanted to end up?
Never. I never doubted it. And, you know, I've had a sort of, say, a tough career. You know, I've chosen a difficult path for myself by putting myself into, you know, the top restaurants in the world and under some of the most pressured environments. But, you know, I would do it all again to gain the knowledge that I've gained and to learn the things that I've learned. Although I worked in very tough kitchens, I worked under great people that taught me so much. Yeah. And it was definitely paid off. It was definitely worth that sticking at it and that sort of loyalty and discipline that I learned that really, really made me who I am.
Well, on to the third desert island dish. Claire, what is the best dish you've ever eaten?
This is such a difficult question because I've eaten some incredible food in my life. I have a dish that sticks in my mind. It's from Louis Ken's and Alain Ducasse. When I went to work there, there was a dish that was a vegetables cooked in black truffle. And it's simple. I love vegetables, especially of that region. You know, vegetables are phenomenal from there. And you know, you'd go to the market every day and pick the vegetables. And then they were cooked with black truffle and finished with a really stunning olive oil of the region, some balsamic vinegar, a little bit of sherry vinegar. And they were dressed in a plate and almost like a presentation where it's almost like a bouquet of flowers, but a bouquet of vegetables. And this sauce, it was all the cooking juices and the truffle was just finished and poured over the sauce with lots of the sort of leaves and tops and things that would come from the raw vegetable. And I just loved that contrast, fresh, beautiful. It looked stunning and it was healthy and good. And it's still one of my favourite dishes.
How long ago was it that you ate that?
It would have been going back 15, 16 years ago since I worked there. And that dish was the dish that really stuck with me.
Isn't it amazing how you can remember the taste of something so vividly? I don't know. It's just incredible that food can stay with you for that long. This is a cliche of a question, but I have to ask you, your signature dish you very humbly describe as a potato.
Yeah.
But can you tell us in a little bit more detail? Because it's not just a potato, is it?
It is just a potato and it isn't. It's a two-day process. It's not difficult to make. It's just a little bit of time involved. You've got to have a good grower as well, amazing potato product to start with. But it's a dish that is really about where I come from. I have the habit of eating potatoes still every day. I love potatoes. And I have this memory of my aunt and uncle's potato farm and digging the potatoes. They had the field right by the ocean, so the soil was full of the minerality of the ocean. Mm. And that led me to thinking about cooking the potatoes in seaweed. So we cook them in seaweed, and then they kind of marinate for 2 days, and they kind of cure the potato, so it becomes a really firm texture. And then we serve it with like smoked herring and trout roes, salt and vinegar potato crisps, which is my favorite snack, and lots of fresh herbs, sorrel, and then a butter sauce, which is using the rest of the seaweed back into the sauce. So it's kind of quite a rich dish, but really nostalgic. And you know, it became a real hit for the restaurant. Now, when you create a dish like that, you just don't know what other people are going to think. You don't know if it's going to connect with other people. And that dish just really did resonate with so many people. So that's why it's become kind of the signature.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So it's obviously one that you're very passionate about, but there were others that could have been, but this is the one that really took off. Like you say, you can never predict which the ones people are going to really connect with.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
And it's other people that decide what your signature dish is. It's not you.
I think I was very ignorant about that. I think I was kind of thinking that was like, you know, when someone asks you what's your signature dish, that was just like what you say. But no, that's, you've been told that's your signature dish.
Yeah, because it's the one that you want. It's the one that's most popular.
Yeah, pretty good one to be known by.
Yeah, yeah.
You worked for Gordon Ramsay before leaving to work for Alain Ducasse, and you travelled the world before coming back to take over as chef patron for Gordon Ramsay. How important was that time away in terms of your career and everything that you learned?
Yeah, very important. You know, travelling, we call it staging or working for work experience under great chefs. You know, I spent time in the US with Thomas Keller, Per Se in French Laundry. I spent time in Spain, you know, El Sol de Can Roca, Arzac. You know, I've worked in Australia. I travelled a lot. And it was very, very important in terms of understanding different cultures, food, the way people cook. It also helps you to kind of understand yourself more and your own culture more in a reflective way. And then obviously working for Alain Ducasse was almost like a finishing school for me, which was phenomenal and like just the best, most amazing place. It's still my favorite restaurant
really
in the world. Yeah, I just love it. I just think it's so stunning. And I remember when I was just talking to Gordon about where I was going to go to work, I was ready to leave and move on, and I told him I wanted to go there, and he said, go there, because he said, suck it up, live in Monaco, or just outside, because I couldn't afford to, but see that lifestyle and suck it up. And I just absolutely loved it, and it was an incredible place to be.
Does it change your experience of eating in a restaurant when you've worked in the restaurant?
I guess so, but yes and no. I mean, I still go back and eat there maybe once a year or so, and I've done a few events there for Hands with my team now going back there.
Oh, amazing.
Which has been really lovely, because it's really quite touching, because my team then will say, now I understand why you do that, because the connection of how you've learned how to cook, it's all in those threads, I guess. And it's like if you're a carpenter, you know, you're like Chippendale, there's a style of cooking and there's a way you would do something, and you've obviously learned those ways of doing stuff, you pass it on.
Yeah.
And then when you connect back to the places again, your team then see how it fits or why.
Yeah, and they get a much better understanding of why you are who you are.
Yeah.
Do you think if you hadn't have had that time away, would you have ended up as chef patron for Gordon?
I don't think so. I definitely wouldn't have been as rounded as a chef as I am now or as I was then. I was still very young when I went there. When I took over, I was still only 28 years old when I took over that position, and that was a lot of pressure. You know, I wasn't sure that I was ready at all, and Gordon was like, no, you are, that's why you're here. And he was always very reassuring in all stages of my career, saying, well, you know exactly what to do, this is what you've trained for. And when I thought about it, and of course I had trained for it, I did know what to do.
Would you say he's been your biggest mentor?
Definitely, without a doubt. Yeah, still today is my biggest mentor, yeah.
Your kitchen is famously civil, but you've said that earlier in your career you were quite shouty, but you grew out of it pretty quickly because it wasn't very you. I can't really imagine you being very shouty, but were you that way because that was what was happening in the kitchens you were in and it kind of seemed like that was how it was done?
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. And, you know, you don't have to ask Gordon about that because he'll give you a few stories.
But, about you shouting?
Yes.
Okay.
But also how I changed. Mm. And then he saw that transformation and how I became myself and filled into my own shoes because I had big shoes to fill. Mm. And, you know, as the first woman to take over a 3 Michelin-starred restaurant at the age of 28, in the UK, it was always the fear of losing those 3 Michelin stars. And it was took me a while to grow into my own shoes and behave like myself. Mm. You're very much trying to mimic the way that others had done things because that's how I thought that it needed to be done.
Yeah. I mean, even a 28-year-old who isn't under all of that pressure is still trying to figure out all of those things about who they are. And so, yeah, I can't even imagine what that must have been like. Claire, we're on to the most important question of the day. What is your favourite sandwich?
I love a sandwich.
Good.
Now, sandwiches and salads are two things that I think the more ingredients, the better.
Okay, yes.
So, but I would say that favourite sandwich would be down the lines of like a BLT, but with onions as well.
Like a pickled onion?
No, like raw red onions.
Oh, okay.
But I really like bacon, tomato and onion as a toasted sandwich. But I do think that the more things you put in a sandwich, the better.
Yeah.
So, like, lots of ingredients. Salad, mayonnaise, chicken, ham, everything, cheese, everything.
Would you ever have a sandwich on your menu?
It depends if I had a cafe, but...
is there no way to do a fine dining
sandwich? I do actually have a sandwich on the menu. Caviar sandwich.
There you go. Tell us about it.
So a caviar sandwich is actually made with layers of buckwheat crepe. Mm. And in between the layers, there's like a layer of chopped egg yolk, chopped egg white, creme fraiche, chives, herbs. And then it's topped with caviar. So it's the traditional garnishes that you would eat with caviar, but all made into one bite in this little triangle sandwich that kind of pop in your mouth.
I mean, it's no BLT, but that sounds pretty good. So you did get a lot of media attention when you took over as at Gordon Ramsay's restaurant. You were A, incredibly young, but also it was because you were a woman and it was the first time that a woman had been at the helm of a 3 Michelin-starred restaurant. I read something that said that up until the point that you were getting all the media attention, you hadn't really thought about the fact that you were a woman and that that was unusual. Is that really true?
Yes, yeah.
Really? Even though in all the kitchens you're cooking in, you must have been in the minority.
Yes, yeah, definitely, and often the only woman. But it just wasn't my focus at all. I was so focused at being the best that I could be. And it didn't really occur to me that I didn't have any female role models or it wasn't that important to me. I've realised as I've grown up, it is important to other women. It just wasn't, I guess I was just so single. But, you know, my focus was just to get to the top. And I was lucky to work with some great men. And it didn't really occur to me. I had great mentors as my role models as men. And Gordon and Alan Ducasse, who were incredibly good to me. Yeah, I didn't really think about it. And I felt wrong in a way that was why I got so much attention. It wasn't because I was a great chef. It was because I was a female.
No.
Yeah.
I can see why you say that, but that wouldn't have been why. But must have been a frustrating thing to have that feeling when you've worked so hard and achieved so much and then it's sort of reduced down to the fact you're a woman, which has nothing to do with it.
And I think a lot of young women feel like that also. It was an interesting I had when I was given the world's best female chef award. I wasn't sure I really wanted to accept it. And I did in the end because someone gave me a bit of a kick up the backside and said to me, if you want to change things, you need to be on a platform to change things. And you know, and it really thought, well, yeah, actually I should be the voice. And you know, lots of young women were very inspired by it and lots of them weren't. Some of them think I shouldn't have accepted it. But
really,
I think,
does anybody think that?
Yeah. And I probably would have been one of those young women that disagreed with the award because I felt I deserved it on my own merit as a chef. But I think that the important thing is having the conversation. And that's what I've realised as I've grown up.
Yeah.
So the person that gave me the kick up the backside was absolutely right. Take it and say what you want to say. But if you don't take it, you won't say anything.
Yeah. And hopefully we will get to a place where it is just world's best chef, and that includes women.
Yeah.
But we're not there.
We're not there, and there is no rights and wrongs, and whatever anyone inspires, whatever inspires people, I think, is great.
Yeah, and you can't be what you can't see, which I think is why what you've achieved is so amazing, because it's groundbreaking. And normally you do have to be able to see someone ahead of you that you can kind of look up to. But from what you're saying, it's even more impressive because nothing was a limiting factor. You just wanted to be the best, and that's ultimately what you became. Why do you think it is such a male-dominated industry? I know that's changing, and I know you're doing amazing things to change that, but why historically has that been the way?
I think it's the same in a lot of industries at the top level. I think it was just that cycle of it not being a great environment to work in, and mm-hmm. the more men are in it, the more, I guess, less attractive it is for women. I kind of think that family life has also a lot to play in it, and I think that it's just not attractive for lots of women to go into kitchens and hospitality, whereas now it's considered, you know, much more attractive industry. But the way it's changed so much has just been really refreshing, because it's such a lovely environment now compared to how it used to be. And it would never be great to have teams of all females or all males. You need that balance, and people are so much better. I remember even back when there was no women allowed to serve on floor.
Really?
Yeah, in the dining
room. What, front of house?
Yeah, front of house. Yeah, in the 3 Michelin-starred restaurant I'd worked in, because they didn't see women should serve. And now that particular restaurant is headed up by a woman, and there's lots of young women in the dining room. So it's changed. It's so lovely now. It's like it just really feels fresh, you know, and how things have changed, rather than that really sort of heavy masculine dining room with lots of men serving in it. And it's just so much more refreshing. Yeah.
The way there are members clubs where you can only go in if you're a man.
Yeah, I mean, just horrible places.
Yeah, we've got a long way to go, but we're getting there. We're on to the fifth desert island dish. What's the dish you eat the most often?
It would be roast chicken. Yeah, really something so simple that, yeah, I'd like to do it on barbecue at home, a bit like a beer can chicken style. So I just salt, pepper on the stand, olive oil, put it in. And it kind of cooks slowly, roasts, smoky, beautiful over charcoal.
Oh, that sounds so good. Do you do all of the cooking at home?
I do, actually. Yeah, my husband is not a bad cook, but it's just easier. I don't want to do the washing up, so I do the cooking.
That's a good trait, definitely. By the time you'd reached your mid-30s, you'd accomplished more than many chefs twice your age. And it was, in your words, time for a new challenge. You say you wanted to be marked by your own destiny in opening the restaurant. How scary was that to do?
Yeah, it was probably the toughest time of my career. I had, you know, come from being the very top of my game with Restaurant Gordon Ramsay. We had everything. It was amazing. And we maximised every guide. But I decided I wanted to challenge myself to create something with my own vision from scratch and prove to myself that I could do it. So the risk, I took the risk of really, I was a hero to zero. And, you know, opening something from scratch with a whole new team, you know, without a huge budget to do it. I put everything on the line financially, reputationally. I didn't say too much about what we wanted to create. You know, I just thought, let's get going, do the best that we can. Try and make the business work, because everything's riding on this.
Yeah, no pressure.
The business needs to work. Otherwise, I don't know how I'm going to pay all the money back.
Oh my God, Claire, that's making me feel really stressed thinking about it. You're so brave. Did it feel brave?
No, it felt scary, I think. But I had faith in like the team and myself and the team ability that I knew we would put the work in, and I knew we had the ability to do it. So it was always a case of just refocus, and just keep going, keep our heads down, keep getting better every day. We just kept that work ethic and the pace that we were able to build when we opened the restaurant to keep getting better every day was really, really important. We were lucky because we were full from day one, which was really good.
I don't think that was luck. That's very modest to say. I don't want to presume, but obviously coming from 3 Michelin stars, that was a lot of pressure. Was that a goal that you were aiming for, or were you not even thinking about that sort of side of things?
I wasn't really thinking about it directly. Of course, if I think about it in the back of my mind, the biggest priority was like making the restaurant full, busy, financially, work financially.
Yeah.
And I was just grateful for every single person that walked through the door. And my focus was everybody that walks through the door, like, make sure they have a great time and they want to come back. And I've had that still from day one to still now. It's if you keep that attitude, everything else will come. So it's really about focusing on the guests and the customer and just making sure they get what they want, and then keep evaluating ourselves. And I always thought, well, realistically, we'd get 2 stars. But I just kept going till we kept polishing what we were doing.
Yeah, it's amazing. So you hadn't even been open 3 years when you got the 3rd star. Like, how did that feel? Do you remember where you were when you found out?
Yeah, it was weird because we were in lockdown. So we were actually doing this delivery service that we were doing. So we hadn't even, like, 2020. So we opened in August 2017. So we were in lockdown, like, 2020, January, when the Michelin Guide came out. It was obviously all via Zoom. And they said, can you get on the call? And of course, I was like, you know, so much speculation. It's like,
actually tell you on a phone call?
Yeah, that's how I found out. No, so I didn't find out on the phone call. They just called me and said, can you get on this Zoom call? And I was like thinking, well, when they've had the call from Paris, you're like, right, can't say anything to anyone. Like, you can't jinx it. And then I just had the Zoom call, and we were in the restaurant with only a couple of people because we were just all that was here to kind of prepare, like, these meals that we were doing every weekend. And then, yeah, that was it. And it was just odd celebration.
Odd because you were in lockdown, but also when you've been working so hard towards a goal, like, how does the actual moment feel when that happens? Is it everything that you think it's going to be, or is it actually quite, you kind of don't know how to react?
It was, I say it was everything that I wanted, even if it was in lockdown, even if we couldn't really celebrate it. I mean, obviously achieving it's like a dream come true, life achievement, and, you know, driving to work every day, just thinking, yes, you know, we did it, you know, we did do it. And then, of course, the reality of keeping it down the line, that all comes in.
Don't worry about that.
Expectations go through the roof of people traveling across the world to dine with you. But it's the challenge of it. And that's the fun of what we do, the fact that you keep evolving.
Yeah. How far in advance do people book to come and eat here?
It's 91 days. So we open our reservations 91 days in advance, and people will wait. So midnight, 91 days in advance, and people will wait up and book. And it can be anywhere in the world, which I always find really humbling. You know, even our American guests, and they'll be like, oh, you know, we're waiting up to get that booking to make sure that we got it, which is so, so humbling.
It's incredible. As if running a restaurant isn't all-consuming enough, you did also find time to cook for Prince Harry and Meghan's wedding. What was that like? How did that come about?
Yeah, that was amazing. That was, back 2018.
Megan, so you just
eaten.
Opened?
Yeah, we just opened. Meghan had eaten here, and obviously she loved the food. They do. The royal family love food and love produce, and we're very, very, you know, British, all about British produce, British producers. And so, yeah, then they just connected and said, you want to do it? And the rest is history. It was amazing. And we've had, a great relationship ever since.
Amazing.
And we stay in touch, and they're great. They were so much fun to work with. The whole team sort of really warmed to them, because the whole thing was very much hush and quiet. And we had the secrecy around the whole thing. It was quite good fun. So it was running in and out of palaces, then running in and out of here, side here. So it was actually really amusing. And they're really fun people also, which just made it like a real pleasure.
So the restaurant was open as you were doing that?
No, closed.
Okay, I was going to say.
Yeah, we took the whole team with us to do it.
Did it make you want to do more events? Or
we do a lot of events, actually, anyway. Various things all over the world. So we're quite used to doing events.
Okay.
But that one was particularly special.
Yeah.
And had to run absolutely to clockwork. So there was nothing that could go wrong on that one. As you can imagine, everything stops for that, you know, and we just had this military precision.
Was everything perfect?
I think it was pretty good, actually. Yeah, we had practiced it so many times that we had, it was like, there's so many people on it to make sure it was work. We had practiced so much. And everyone was on form to make sure it was a perfect day. And it was really, I do think it was a fairy tale wedding. Yeah. It really was a perfect day.
Well, on to the sixth desert island dish. What's your go-to dinner party dish? Do you get to throw dinner parties, Claire? I mean, you're kind of busy.
Yeah, the odd dinner party, go-to dinner party dish, right. So I think the things that are easiest to do that I would do is things like a lobster thermidor.
Mm. Oh, my God, Claire, can I come round?
Yeah. Yeah, so something like lobster thermidor, and if you're being luxurious with it, either black truffle or caviar on the top. But it's something that you can prepare in advance. It's delicious, decadent, beautiful, and you then just grill them. Mm. So anything that is really good to get prepared in advance. So it's one of those really good dishes.
I mean, that sounds silly, obviously, because you're Claire Smith. But I mean, A, people must be lining up to come for a dinner party at your house. But B, do you feel like there is an expectation when people come that they're, you know, eating at Claire Smith's house and they're expecting it to be like core?
No. I think most of my friends know me well enough. Mostly it would be like they would get a barbecue if they come to my house.
Okay.
Or a roast. I like to do like whole roasted turbot and things like that.
I think I read that during lockdown, that was obviously, as for lots of people, the most time you'd ever really spent at home. And so you were doing much more home cooking than you'd really ever done before. Like, there's such a big difference between the kind of food that you're making at work and the kind of food that you're making at home. What did you find yourself making?
I made everything. Like, I really enjoyed it. I tried to cook, like, different dishes every single day without a recipe book to see how many days I could go for without running out of ideas.
Where did you get to?
I think I just did the whole of it. Like, but I pulled out like things like steak Diane. I had done like madeleines. I had done fried chicken, like in quiches, like banana breads, like all random things. Victoria sponge. I can't even remember when the last time I had made a Victoria sponge, but I kept just pulling things out. And
and your husband had to do a lot of running, I think I read.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
The sign of a good lockdown. So on Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook corner. So I'd love to know, what is your most treasured cookbook?
I have many, many cookbooks, but like probably thousands.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
At home?
Yeah, there's quite a few here in our office at the restaurant, but a lot at home, lots in garages.
So you kind of collect them. Do you read all of them?
No. You know, I used to when I was younger, and now obviously time, you know, I'll have a flick through some books, but the books that I loved the most when I was younger is probably the French Laundry Cookbook. Mm. Thomas Keller's French Laundry Cookbook would have been the one that I really loved the most.
Mm. You think that's been the most influential one?
I think so. And the, you know, the Alain Ducasse as well. My first ever book was Cuisine à la Carte by Anton Mozerman. I bought that when I was 15. But the book that, the encyclopedia as well from Alain Ducasse, The Grand Livre, was a very influential book as well.
Yeah. Claire, we're on to the seventh final desert island dish. What is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off the desert island?
Oh, so I love black truffle linguine with parmesan, aged parmesan. It's like simple, classic. Roasted turbot with asparagus and morels and like a vin jaune sauce.
I'm not paying for this, Claire.
Yeah. I know, I'm always picking quite luxurious dishes.
No, it sounds amazing.
I mean, of course, like the roast chicken would have to go in there as well.
Yeah. And what pudding are you going to have? Are you a pudding person?
I am. I have three favourite puddings. They are rumbaba, tartar tan, and tiramisu.
You could have a trio.
Yeah,
or a pudding, a dessert table to send you off. You might as well go all out. Yeah. Claire, those are your desert island dishes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So there we are, another delicious day of desert island dishes. Don't forget, you can find me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes, where you'll find snippets from the interviews, lots of recipes, and much more. You can visit the website desertislanddishes.co or sign up for my weekly newsletter, Dinner Tonight. You can find that at dinnertonight.substack.com. Every week I send you one easy and delicious weeknight recipe. Thank you very much again to Mould & Salt, our sponsor for this season of Desert Island Dishes. Thank you for helping us bring the podcast to you every week. And I will see you next week. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.